All right, here we are, the beginning of topic 7. I called it the Transcendental Epoche, and then when I actually did my reading, I realised he was calling it the Universal Epoche. He uses universal and transcendental interchangeably. But the Universal Epoche is the second stage of Husserl's entrance into phenomenology. The first stage, which I think was last week, wasn't it, was the scientific epoche, which was to put science out of play, our sort of objective understanding of the world and of our brains and what our brains are doing, sometimes he called it a reduction back to what we would say is the life world, which is just the world as we experience it with the ordinary worldly objects and people around us. But that isn't the... As we ended last week's lecture, we were talking about some total transformation, somewhat like a religious conversion. And the scientific epoche isn't that. He's talking about the universal epoche. And that's... I think the rest of the course is about this, but this is where he first introduces it, and it's quite. I think I would like I would say last week, it's quite elusive, because as we look into this class, I think you'll find that he doesn't actually tell anyone what to do. He never actually says what to do, because it's not a matter of doing anything. It's a matter of getting the idea. So if you were reading Husserl thinking, well, okay, so he's going to give me a set of instructions now about how to effect a universal epoche. And really, essentially what he's doing is he's describing what it's like to be in it all the time. In one way or another, hoping that you'll pick the idea up. So quite often, and you get this with a lot of phenomenologists, you're waiting for the punchline. You know you think he's building up to say something really big at the end, and then you get to the end of the book, and it never happens. I guess the thing to realise is that the whole book is it. There isn't a punchline at the end. It's more that he's endeavouring to point to something that you can't say explicitly in language, but you can say inexplicitly by leading someone into a certain state of consciousness by being in that place yourself and speaking from it. It's a bit like we start to attune ourselves to where someone is coming from, and that's really the process that's going on here. And phenomenology itself, in a way, is a kind of an attunement to a certain... I mean, we don't have a good word for it. That's why, if we lived in a different culture where this was, if you like, something quite central, and already understood, we'd have a kind of a language for it, and we'd bring up our children in a way to understand what we're talking about. But we live in a culture that has no language for what we want to talk about. So we have to approach it in this way by somehow or other feeling our way into what Husserl is talking about. We're feeling our way into it. And it's quite, when I say it's elusive, it's like there can be, and this is for me too, there can be days when I'm reading Husserl, and it's full of profound meaning for me. And there can be other days where it's just a bunch of words. So your sort of understanding of philosophy at this level is not utterly dependent, but 50% of it is where you're at. And the other, you know, you need the other 50%. You need to have where Husserl is at, and the reading the philosophy is a meeting of the two. But you can, at the back of all of this, there's a certain state of disidentification that. He's really, the whole lecture is talking about this. If you're not disidentified, then in a sense everything that's being said will be sort of without meaning. It's very subtle in that way. So having said that's my introduction. That was to allow James to arrive. Yes, that's all right. No, I'm hoping for even a full house. There's a full house, I think. People who are still, who not people who are still, but people who are taking the course seriously. So at the same time, you remember Husserl has a kind of a project in the back of his mind, which is this particular way that he's taken in the crisis. He takes various ways in different books that he's written, but his way in this particular approach is he's very interested in the history of philosophy and the fact that objective science sort of hangs in midair. It isn't actually grounded in our immediate experience. So his sort of way in here is partly to start to indicate that there's a problem with objective science in that it takes what he's going to call transcendental subjectivity for granted, but not even for granted, doesn't even recognise what it is. So objective science doesn't recognise that it's sort of hanging in midair, that it's relying on this intelligence that is what he would say constituting the world, and doesn't recognise that there's an intelligence that's constituting the world to begin with. And then science takes that constituted world and objectifies it. But he's saying, well, that's only half a science. You know, the idea of a universal science is the universal science also encompasses the subjectivity or the consciousness that is constituting the world in the first place. So there's no true science without taking this, the other half of the universe, really, the consciousness that's constituting the world. If you don't take that into account, then it's not really a universal science, and there's no coherence in it, which is how it is, which is how it stands, which our scientific disciplines, if you ever sort of wandered through the university departments, are fractured in that way, particularly down the lines of those that study or are to do with human beings and those that study or are to do with objective entities like physics and chemistry and biology. And there's a whole list of them, actually, that just recently I bothered to make. If you are interested in that sort of distinction... The part of the objective sciences is almost at the crown is not actually physics, it would be logic, mathematics, and interestingly enough now computer science. They're all the areas which study, if you like, the form of objective thinking, and then they, if you like, are the a priori sciences that then the exact sciences, if you like, the mathematical sciences, then use that form of thinking to study their own domains. And that's where physics, chemistry and biology... but you've also now got the broad concept of earth sciences and the broad concept of space sciences as well, to do with cosmology, the origins of the universe, etc., and earth sciences to do with ecology and climate science, geology. You've got that is a semi-coherent group. They're not entirely, you can't take biological entities and entirely successfully reduce them to the explanations at the level of physics, but there's plenty of ideas that will one day be done. But then on the other side, you've got the humanities and the arts.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
But I am warm.
Yes, it's quite. We've already been talking.
Today,
we've already been talking about it. In fact, I'm feeling like I might be taking my jumper off. You're definitely ready.
I am ready for any eventuality. Sorry, I guess.
Yes. So on that side, the just talking about science and the various divisions of science, they kind of absolutely. It's the absolutely core subject is psychology. The kind of science that we're missing, the unity that we're missing is that we don't have a clear idea of how to study the human psyche. We've got plenty of ideas how to do it, but they all disagree with each other, and there's no coherence like there is in the exact sciences, where there's a broad affiliation of agreement about how to go about studying phenomena, and there's no such broad agreement about how to study the phenomena of subjectivity or consciousness. So, and so Husserl's approach, and many it's one of his key aims, if you like, in the crisis, is to try and bring human subjectivity and scientific objectivity together in some kind of unified form. And for that, the intention here that he's beginning with in this lecture is to say, well, how do we study human subjectivity, or subject, not even human subjectivity, finally, he's, I think we would say consciousness itself. How do we study it? How do we get out of our subjective, relative, personal differences and views, and in some way make a science of it without doing what has been done before, which is to objectify it and treat subjectivity as if it was some kind of not exactly physical, but something like an object. And if you remember, I'm just giving you sort of a little bit of memory back into, this is all comes from Locke, Berkeley and Hume, the idea in a way that human subjectivity can be looked at in an objective way as if it is a kind of stream of sense. And we can just study the stream of sense. And there are various attempts to do that where we treat the colour sensation as if it's a kind of an objective thing, as if we were studying atoms and molecules. And you can start to see, well, how does perception work? Well, perception works because there are sort of atoms of sensation that are kind of grouped together to form the idea of things and bodies, and you can kind of assemble a sort of an understanding of human perception that's entirely objectified and then fed back into how the brain works, and that's happening. That's partly my own area of research has been looking into how we can explain experience in terms of what the brain's doing, which is the objectification of experience. And if that succeeds, if you like, if neuroscience succeeds in giving a complete explanation of experience in objective terms, meaning you've just felt a pain, well, that is this event happening in your brain. You've just felt love. Ah, that's this event happening in your brain. The aim, if you like, of an objectified psychology, in the scientific sense, would be finally to be able to give an account of everything that you experience in terms of something happening in the brain. And in a way, I think we've looked at this already, that would be a kind of something terrible will have happened then. Because in a way, if we ever arrived at such a place, we would then be completely unconscious of consciousness. Because anyone who spoke about consciousness would just be referred to the brain. And I think you might recognize that's how that's occurring anyway in our medical understanding of how to treat depression and anxiety and etc. etc. The view is more and more coming, well, there's something going wrong in your brain. We can fix it either with drugs that alter the chemistry of the brain, or we can fix it with some kind of therapy that alters the connections in the brain. The CBT is an example of that. Although that, I'm not saying that the people who practice it necessarily see themselves as holding that view, but in the background, the reason cognitive behavioural therapy is so successful is because it's
measurable.
It's measurable, exactly. You can say, what difference does it make? And if you can measure that it makes a difference, then it's got an objective effectiveness.
As a therapist, as a counsellor myself, I have a lot of clients coming back to me because they had CBT, and CBT, you know, they understood that it was sort of, you know, CBT counselling from the college or university, so that they would go from A to B and they could be ticked off and they're finished case. And they come to me because that wasn't enough for them, because it helped them overcome something, but it didn't really help them to really feel differently, to understand things truly differently.
Yes, yes.
That sort of top level, really.
Yeah, surface stuff. You know, it gives you coping mechanisms, but it doesn't change really your psyche.
So, I'm just giving an overview again. The situation for psychology is that there are various different approaches, various different therapies, but psychology itself as a science does not have an agreed or unified conception or understanding of what human subjectivity is. From out of... you see, if we had such an understanding... and I'm suggesting that actually we're heading towards such an understanding, which is that we're just brain machines, which I would think was a kind of a tragic outcome. But if we once you arrive at a core understanding that the whole area agrees on, then all of the therapies and understandings of how we deal with the human psyche would come out of a unified centre. Whereas at the moment we've got various therapies that have different understandings of what the human psyche is. You know, you've got CBT, which is a quite an objectified, materialistic understanding. And then you've got psychoanalysis, which what's the word I want to use? Proposes? That there's some sort of something like the unconscious, which is a pure psychic inheritance that doesn't have any physical instantiation in the brain. You know, there's quite a deep difference there in the ontology. You know, the idea of what is. If you've got the idea that there's a collective unconscious that's immaterial and kind of a storehouse of all human experience, you've got something that's in effect an extraordinary rejection of all of what the exact sciences consider to be real. And they sort of sit, they all sit together in our civilization, you know, all of these different views of how things are. Yes.
Could not the beauty of it all be that all of it is true and all of it is, so that there are some things that are measurable and that then there are some that are not, and then there is, you know, things that can be explained by science, and then there are some that are not, and that is just the beautiful, you know, existence of this world.
Yes, and I think it's, we've got a few minutes to just to go into that. That there's a sort of I've neglected to mention this really. There's because the it's not really my deeply my area, but I know that there's a kind of a drift of a kind of a higher level understanding in our culture. Not saying that you're holds of this, but there's something of it in what you were saying, which is saying that in effect, what's going on is that we just take a certain view of things. Like science takes a certain view of things, a Jungian psychologist takes a certain view of things, and somebody who's doing CBT takes a certain view of things, and they've all got their own validity.
And can exist alongside of each other.
And can exist alongside of each other, which eventually ends up in saying, well, I mean, and this is our kind of something that's quite deep in our culture, that really truth is a kind of a relative thing. There isn't really an absolute truth. If we say there's an absolute truth, we're some kind of white patriarchal male dictator. Yes, it's got a
chauvinist.
Yes. Yeah, to say there's an absolute truth is a kind of a throwback to some former attempt by which definitely has occurred to kind of impose some kind of idea of how things are, you know, and it's in religions and it's in dictatorial states, and we've our actual position, which is partly to do with the state of our science, is that nobody can agree on there being any kind of absolute truth. So we've fallen into a sort of a state of that this is probably the best that human intelligence can do, is to have different viewpoints that have their own truth. And this is kind of falling down now into a kind of an extreme state where it's almost like every individual has their own view or their own truth, and each in a way, and this is part of our kind of democratic feeling, everyone has an equal right to their own view, to which I would say something like this. There are definitely levels of understanding, and some levels of understanding, by levels of understanding I mean there is a level of understanding here where you've got a certain understanding of how things are that includes understanding another understanding down here, if you like. That's a lesser or partial understanding. As understanding grows, then it's able to in some sense subsume or understand other people's understandings. You can see where they're coming from, and you can see that there are errors in those understandings. The thing about this idea of relative truth is everybody is on the trail of some kind of truth. It's not the truth that's the problem, it's the error. I mean, what philosophy for me, I guess, is, and what phenomenology is for me, is to at one level, it's the pursuit of error. It's, I think, I don't think that it's possible to say such and such is the absolute truth, but it's definitely possible to say that that is an error, and it's false. So I have a great faith in falsifiability. If you can see that something is false, it, in a sense, it destroys something in you, which would be your former belief in it. And if you like, one of the process of being a philosopher is a matter of destroying beliefs in you that you've acquired, usually just by a matter of being in the culture, and then not replacing them with anything else. You know, that I mean, I had a colleague at university. It's when I first started realizing how things stood in a way with my colleagues. He'd been brought up as an Orthodox Jew, and he'd rejected the whole Jewish faith, but he'd become an out and out materialist, you know, in a response to his rejection of being Jewish. He'd become, do you know, there's a point where you see that something, there's some falsity, but then you bounce to the opposing position and believe in that just as fervently as the position you first held. That and philosophy, in a way, is a willingness to have your beliefs destroyed. And then not know, and in a way, a state of not knowing, of not believing, is when I'm saying there are sort of levels, that's really, if you don't believe something that somebody else believes, in a way you're free of that, and you have a greater consciousness. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
Time of great discoveries.
Yes. So it's not that we're all on this democratic level playing field. I may be a white patriarchal, you know, something or other, but I definitely have the sense that in a way it's a kind of it's a leveling that's leading us into a kind of a meaningless, an anarchic kind of individualism that I find quite disturbing in a way.
So, in what Mike was saying.
Yes, that's sorry, right. Yeah, Nicolette's going to. Yes.
So, I'm trying to see it from that perspective of psychology.
Yes.
So, in each school of psychology, because there are an awful lot, I guess you'd say, well, if you saw it, some sort of belief or something about your childhood or I don't know, whatever, and you profoundly saw that, it wouldn't matter where you saw it, you're just not unifying it. You know, you might see something.
Yes.
Really see something. Which, of course, is lovely if you do really see something.
So I've got I've just
would
like to
say psychoanalysis or
I've got something I just to say about that, because again, you know, I'm like Jung.
Even CBT, you might see something.
The thing there that we're talking about is because Jung was himself, although he didn't speak about Husserl, he spoke about phenomenology, and his position, if you like, was that psychic experiences are pure phenomena of consciousness. You don't have to actually posit the existence of anything beyond the experience itself. And if you have an experience that is in some way freeing, like an insight into how something that happened in your childhood has been determining your behaviour in your adult life, that's been causing you to be make bad choices and be unhappy. And then you see into the past and you see the connection between it. That's all happening just in consciousness. It doesn't involve any belief at all. It doesn't even necessarily involve the belief that A caused B. You just say, well, the fact that I saw that has changed me now. And the fact I've been changed now is also a fact. It's a phenomenological fact. The disturbance in me that was there before is not there now. And that's a pure phenomenon.
And you can, for example, of course you can do studies that, you know, so and so many children out of broken homes will have later a run-in with the law. Yeah, probably, likely. Yeah. And then there are so and so many who don't, because they have a different way of experiencing it. They have a resilience that the others don't have. They, you know, and then so and so many children not in broken homes will have a run-in with with the law, you know. Yeah. So it's like, there is an individual in psychology that is impossible to measure, or is only possible to measure to a certain extent, and then the rest is something that's immeasurable.
So coming back to phenomenology and this idea that there are various ways of seeing things, essentially what phenomenology is saying is in a way, yes, well, the way you see something is a kind of phenomenon as well. Yes, and the stance that phenomenology takes is, well, so the way you see something is a phenomenon of the field of consciousness that we're looking at. We're simply looking at the phenomena of consciousness. We're observing that, and we're taking no position on it whatsoever. It's in a way, it's a recognition that what actually exists for us is what's happening now in our immediate stream of consciousness. Now, and within that, we may believe in the existence of things that are in some sense transcendent or outside of that, but we take no position on that.
Because they're using phenomenology, as you know, in psychology.
Yes.
I can't really explicate how.
Yes, but phenomenology starts from the position of saying, well, if you like, it's what is what you experience. And when you experience the being of something, that is something. I'm getting ahead of myself in this lecture. That is something that your consciousness is constituting. And some things that we consider to exist. I'm in a bit of a fine area here, because where phenomenology finally takes you is into a questioning of being, of what does it mean for something to be anyway, and into a realization that, in a way, it's our consciousness itself that is granting being. And that gets you to then look at the whole way that that works, the whole process of how the granting of the being of things works, and to a certain extent, a close look at how that process works will almost naturally cause one to recognize that. There are things that we believe in the existence of, without sufficient evidence. But I think I'm headed off in a direction where, I'll give you a very simple example, like like the idea that I had of the Russians, I had a certain idea of the being of the Russians in the 1960s and 1970s as I was being brought up, that was an entirely fabricated out of stories without any actual experience of any Russian person or of ever having been to Russia. So I had an entire fantasy, really, also deliberately manipulated by, you know, the West, and the West had a certain view of Russia that, but I had a sort of a dream image of what Russia was and what Russian people were, that had no reality in it whatsoever, had never had any kind of confirmatory, direct, immediate kind of experience to uphold it. So one thing that phenomenology does is, if you like, it, you start to withdraw your acceptance and your belief in the existence of things beyond what is immediately apparent to you. And in fact, what's immediately apparent to you is quite a small world, and quite a handleable world, actually. What's immediately apparent to you generally is the person that you're living with, your children, the person you know at the shops, the fub class, who you know at work. Do you know, there's a circle of your own life. I think I've mentioned this before. I sometimes look upon it like a sort of a rabbit hole. You know, my experience of England includes, you know, the M27, you know, and right down to the A38, and there's a little area in Devon that I actually know. You know, the rest of it, you know, Wolverhampton, just a pure fantasy for me. You know,
fantasy.
Yes.
Glamorous.
Yeah. Well, I pick on Wolverhampton because, you know, as I was indulging that fantasy, it turned out, I think Wolverhampton was one of the sort of strongest areas that wanted to leave the EU. I think it was certainly. I like to look at maps like that, but they're fantasy maps. You know, if phenomenology is a matter of bringing back, well, what do you actually, what does it mean to actually have a sufficient evidential experience of something? And it turns out that the actual sphere of your life, I'm going to start the lecture in a minute. And even then, if you bring it right down to your relationship with one other human being, they can also be like Russia. Do you know, you build a whole picture there, a whole model. I like to call it a doll. You know, you have a doll. This doll has certain motivations in it. And if you don't like someone, it's a very bad doll. And you take certain aspects of someone's behaviour, and you join the dots together and you say, oh yes, they did that because of that, and they're a very bad person, or somebody else is a very good person. But it's quite, maybe you've come across this in life, sometimes you actually, somebody does something shocking and you see, oh, it was just a doll. There's an actual unpredictable being here who I don't really know. So do you know the we're continuously in a state where we're imagining the being of things that don't exist. Yes.
Works very well with pets.
Pets.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dogs.
Yes.
She smiles.
Yes. 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 I had a dog that used to bare his teeth when he was pleased to see you, and that was certainly that's definitely a smile, right? Yes, 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 yes. I'm digressing a long way there, but because it all comes out of a certain, this power that we have that we don't recognize, that we project being, and we don't we easily project completely fictitious being outside of ourselves. And one, you know, if we're looking at phenomenological psychology, it would be a matter of, in a way, recognizing those projections are coming from out of oneself, which does lead you back to Jung. You know, that was Jung's view of how the psyche works. Whatever you're unconscious of, you see it outside of you. So the structure of the life... actually, the first slide is quite different to what I'm talking about, so we'll just let that die away. Because we're back in... The problem of the lecture for Husserl is what he's asking, he doesn't maybe not said it explicitly, is, well, okay, we've got this domain of human subjectivity, and we've been having a big talk about it, right back to Kant and his recognition that experience just isn't a matter of already formed things appearing on the cave wall, that in fact there must be certain capacities in us that enable us to even identify an object as being an object. And objects just don't appear by themselves. We must have some kind of, if you like, innate ideas in us that enable us to form the idea of there being space and time and objects around us. How are we to study that life world that we inhabit, which is, and he's already said, it's subjective relative. My life world is different to yours. We all have different life worlds, different views of things, even right down to the fact that I've got a different view of the table to you because I'm sitting here, you're sitting there. But there's all of your capacities, all of your past, how that colours your experience, the life worlds, even within the same culture, quite distinct. And then as you start moving cultures, I mean, there was a whole, quite a fascinating study on colour words and how in different cultures certain colours that we distinguish just aren't distinguished. There's no name for them, no word for them. And they're kind of a wondering then of, well, if you don't distinguish orange from red, what's that like? Are you still seeing orange if you don't distinguish it? What is it actually like to look through the eyes of someone who doesn't distinguish between red and orange? One's tempted to say they must still see the same as we're seeing, because of course I can't distinguish between one shade of purple and another, if you like, you know. Whereas I think an artist, do you know someone who's really skilled at painting, will have a very fine discrimination of colour that I don't have. So, but I wouldn't think that artist actually had a different, you know, a certain level that the colour experience would be the same, or is it? You know, like John, he seems to be able to sip a glass of wine and say, "Oh, that's good wine," you know, and I just say, "It's wine." You know, but you know, there must be a whole level of taste experience there that's quite different to my own, and maybe there is in colour experience. So do you see our life worlds can be really quite distinct, and as you move across culture, they you know, they differ in ways that we would be you know, it would take a lot of delving to even discover that the difference is there, because, like the dog, right? We project. I mean, there's a default position that says you're experiencing the world just like I am. Yes, that's the only world I know really very well, and over the years, I still think that. I just think that people, if they're not experiencing the world like I am, it's because they haven't attended enough of my classes. that's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? I guess I'm digressing there. It's a difficult thing to investigate. I guess you finally investigate it over the years. probably best in your very your intimate relationships with other people. That's usually where you come up against that. Gosh, we really are different. Or some shocking events that happen in life sometimes show that. So the question is, how do we study all of these life worlds? I mean, the obvious place to start is, and now I just read this. If we set up the goal of a truth, yes, Wes?
I'll have to move you.
Us?
Move us?
Yeah. Oh, council coming.
Council coming?
Yeah, doing a presentation or something.
In there?
I've got your room in the main office. So
in the main office? Are we going to be able to get a projector in there?
I'll get you a projector.
Yeah?
Oh, that's me.
Right now, or?
If possible. Sorry about this.
Yeah. I'll start the lecture in the other room then.
Sure.
Yeah. Sorry about this, everyone.
But you sound excited there.
I have a chance to have a cigarette.
Ah.
Chance for a cigarette. All right. We'll join the recording when we find our next.